Good afternoon, welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. In attendance today are Representative Samuels, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Ramris, Representative Coghill, Representative Lynn. Our prayers go out to Mrs. Lynn for fast, speedy recovery.
She had a doctor appointment today, doing well.
Excellent, we're happy to hear that. We anticipate the arrival shortly of our colleagues, Representative Gruenberg and Representative Holmes, and the record will reflect when they join us. We have several pieces of legislation on the docket. Here comes Representative Gruenberg, it's nice to see you. The first of which is going to be House Bill 359, an act relating to probation and the offense of minor consuming or in possession or control of alcohol, and then we will take up 256, which is the predator, the governor's predator bill. If I could, Representative Dahlstrom, would you adopt the judiciary version of 359, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I wish to move the CS for House Bill Number 359, 25-LS1377/M.
Excellent. As the committee may recollect, we introduced this as a House Judiciary bill. It has enjoyed, I think, wide accolades from those that have had a chance to preview it. Bringing the bill before us today, Representative Holmes is with us. It's nice to see you. Bringing the bill before us is former Emily Stancliffe, and the current. Beatley. Emily Beatley is with us. Emily, would you like to introduce 359 for us, please?
Thank you, and again for the record, my name is Emily Beatley, staff to Representative Ramris. Under the current minor consuming statute, the court is required to place a convicted person on probation for 1 year from the date of conviction or until the person reaches the age of 21, whichever is later. And probation in this case is automatic. What House Bill 359 does is it adds a new section under Alaska Statute 0416050, which gives the courts the authority to terminate probation of those convicted of minor consumption, with the exception of habitual minor consuming, if the person meets the conditions of probation set forth by the court, and continuance of the probation would interfere with the rehabilitation and growth of the person. House Bill 359 was specifically drafted as a betterment bill and is not specific to those applying to the military, although we found that this is one of the largest issues. Individuals other than potential military recruits might also benefit from this legislation. We know that some college applications may require a person to disclose whether or not they're on probation, as well as job applications. And a point was raised earlier in the day that it's possible university students traveling through Canada for sports events might also find this to be an issue. Under House Bill 359, all who are convicted and serving probation for minor consuming, like I said earlier, with the exception of habitual consuming, would be eligible for termination of probation by petition to the court. And we believe this would provide additional incentive for those others to succeed on probation.
Okay, thank you.
And that's my bill.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, thank you. I strongly support the bill, and I appreciate your introducing it to the committee, Mr. Chair. I do have a question, and I can ask you, or possibly Mr. Willover here, on page 2, line 3, the terms rehabilitation, and I think that's going to be pretty well known by the court, but the term growth, will that be something that some of the courts may have trouble with? And I don't know if I should ask you or Mr. Willover that question.
Do
we need to define it more?
I'm not sure biologically when boys stop growing, but
how old are you?
I'm in my early 40s, but
me too.
Should it be adolescent or pre-adolescent? What?
I think you're talking about emotional growth here.
Oh, I thought you were talking about shoe size.
I'm not talking about any size.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, is my belief that the growth would be up to the discretion of the court as to define that, but possibly Mr. Woolover could come up and give you an answer to that as well.
Good work, Emily. Way to get us back right on point. It did.
Could we ask Mr. Woolover that question?
Yes. Mr. Woolover, could you please join us? And this was, who drafted this?
Jerry.
Jerry Luckup drafted it, of course. So I'm not sure where he drew that language or what its legal definition is. Clearly,
it was,
I was
in
mistaken.
The original bill.
Hi, Doug. Welcome.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. Doug Woolover, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. I don't know what growth means. I suspect that it's in there to give judges discretion beyond just rehabilitative goals. I suspect that how they interpret it will vary and be probably closely tied to the specifics of the defendant before the judge. But I don't believe growth is a legal term that I'm familiar with, but probably adds more discretion.
Yes, Representative Cooper.
I am very, thank you, through the chair. I'm very satisfied with what you're saying. I would hope that the courts would be able to apply common sense and we wouldn't need to define it. Do you think that we would need to define it, or could the judges deal with that?
Through the chair, it's of course up to you all. I suspect, I hope too, that courts apply common sense. I think that they normally do.
Doug, how many, we talked earlier this morning, how many minors are under some form of probation with the court? Can you give us some statistics?
I can try, Mr. Chairman. My recollection, and I'm actually having our court staff search through our records now to see exactly, my recollection is that historically we've had about somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,000 minor consuming charges filed each year. I don't know exactly how many end in convictions, and I don't know how many are on probation at any given time, though it would be in the thousands. The committee substitute narrows the bill somewhat in terms of those who might move the court to be removed from their probationary responsibilities because they have to have completed, you know, whatever the court has set out for them. It becomes much like a suspended imposition of sentence kind of procedure. You've got a year or so to make sure you've done everything you're supposed to do. That further narrows it. I'm trying to find out in more detail just how many might be petitioning the court, but at this point I don't really know.
Right. And for the committee's recollection, the notion behind this is that as long as the state of Alaska has its thumb on one of these minors, the U.S. government can't own them. As such, the best vocational rehab program available across the country is not available to some of our youth who might most benefit from it, and that's kind of the impetus for this bill. We have Quinlan Steiner available to answer questions, and then Josh Fink, who would like to testify from the Public Defender's Agency. Representative Samuels, do you have from whom do you have a question?
Okay. Former Ms. Stanford. You used the term habitual. So is this statute would only take place for a first-time offender, or what would be the definition of habitual?
With the chair, Representative Samuels, I believe you should have statutes in your packet. And
I probably do.
Well, I'm only saying that hopefully I can direct you to
what this?
The D of the of section 0416050. And specifically that subsection states a person is guilty of habitual minor consuming or in possession or control if the person was placed on probation under C of this section or has been previously convicted twice.
Okay,
and so we've specifically left out subsection D from the from this legislation.
Okay, for somebody who I've got in this very first sentence, L, B, C, E, B, and C again, I just want to know, this for your first or second time of minor in possession or minor consuming, you could wash your record clean. But on a third time, this would no longer apply.
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, and maybe Annie Carpenetti could inform me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is a second consumer or second person under minor consuming would fall under someone who could receive termination from the courts, and that a third would fall under the habitual consumer.
Okay, with that, if we can go to Josh Fink. Josh, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
If you'll just introduce yourself for the record, Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Josh Fink, the director at the Office of Public Advocacy. And I will keep my testimony very brief, Mr. Chairman. I would like to thank you and the committee for introducing this legislation. While clearly the state should not ever condone underage drinking, the punishment should be proportionate to the crime. And I don't think it was the legislature's intent, they ever intended to preclude kids who were cited for underage drinking from being able to join the military. In my former life as a public defender, I sadly saw this happen on a number of occasions where kids would be at a high school party or something, and they wouldn't even have to be drinking. They could be in the room with the alcohol, and they would get cited, and then they would discover, you know, later when they went to go see about enlisting that they could not do so. And it was, again, it was a sad thing to experience, and probably 10, 12 kids I had this experience with when I was a public defender in the Matsu Valley. I don't think that was ever an intent. I think it was an unintended consequence, and this corrects that. So I would, again, just express my thanks to the committee.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Fink? Seeing none, we thank you for your public testimony. I don't think that General Katkus is with us because he's meeting with Senator Stevens. Do we have him on the line?
I just walked in just now, sir.
Oh, welcome, General. Representative or Vice Chair Dahlstrom was just telling me that you are a retired member of the APD and one of her constituents. And, of course, we've all seen you in uniform, and we're very proud of your service for the state of Alaska. And we have your letter dated February 6th before us. And if you have any remarks, for the record, we'd be very grateful, General Katkus.
Just very briefly.
Yes, sir. Oh, did we lose the general?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Very brief.
No longer.
No.
He's still online.
Okay.
Maybe he's muted.
No, I can hear you guys okay, and
we can hear you also, General.
Okay, great. I apologize for that, trying to get the technology part. The area of this bill, what I'd like to extend the Alaska Army National Guard, we abide by all the standards of the U.S. Army for age, citizenship, education, trainability, physical fitness, and all the other standards that we set forth to include moral standards for enlistment. In looking at the youth that have a challenge or an issue that crops up as a result of utilizing alcohol and the probation that then prohibits them from getting into the military, if there's no compounding issues, usually a juvenile caught or charged with an alcohol violation sometimes has additional charges that automatically make it a disqualifier. But I think the ability to withhold or drop the probationary requirement and give youth the opportunity to join the military, I think, gives it options and provides them the ability to get out of a bad situation, have better mentorship, and gives them a path or a direction, which I think would be very beneficial. Now, I'm speaking both as the Army Guard commander and prior law enforcement, that I see this as anytime you've got more options available, you've got a better chance of success. So, very short and succinct, that's my input to the committee.
Thank you very much, General. Are there questions for General Katkus? Seeing none, we thank you for your comments on the record and for finding time to help us with this judiciary bill. Is there anybody else in the room who wishes to testify, or anybody else?
Mr. Steiner, want to say anything?
Mr. Steiner is available for questions. Do you have a question for him? All right. Is there anybody else in the room, or do we have anybody else online?
I have a question.
Representative Grunberg?
And this is primarily for, I think, Mr. Woolover, although certainly Mr. Fink and Mr. Steiner and anybody else, if it applies. We haven't gotten fiscal notes yet, I'm just wondering, do any of your departments, and I'm going to ask the court system particularly, see this going to be a significant cost deal?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'm trying to find out. Our note, if we have a note, would be based on an anticipated increase in the number of hearings the court would have. If we have, for example, 8,000 people, say, that are currently on probation, for these offenses, because you can be on them for, you can be on probation for years under the current bill. It may be that we anticipate a significant number coming for requesting a hearing, but I need to temper that because I'm not sure how many convictions we end up with as opposed to filings. I'm not sure under how many of them are excluded from the bill yet, or how many would meet the criteria in the new committee substitute. But that's the question I'll be looking at and trying to find an answer to, whether we anticipate enough new hearings to warrant a fiscal note.
I'm not going to ask the other people. I assume the answer is basically the same. I'm going to ask, I guess, Mr. Woolover.
Okay.
I had talked to staff over the lunch hour about a potential an amendment that Mr. Luckhoff is drafting for me.
Right.
He hasn't gotten it yet.
Okay.
But the problem I would like to resolve is on lines 12 and 13, and again on line 14, it talks about having made a good faith effort to make these payments. And if you cut the person loose, what method do we have to see that out of their military pay or whatever, there's an allotment or something so that these payments are made? And I don't want to just limit it to military, because they might be used for other purposes. Here, I'm like the kids going through Canada, or the person gets kicked out of the service or something like that. And we don't have the probation any longer. And I think what Jerry's going to do is to have the remaining unpaid amount be entered as a judgment against the person. And then the court system or the person who's owed the money could then collect on the judgment. That may be the best thing we could do. And unfortunately, it has taken a little bit of time. We don't have the draft yet. It's taking a little bit of time to do this.
Okay.
I'm wondering if I can just ask generally, would the court system have any problem if we did have such, and I may be somewhat premature, but something like a judgment be entered for the unpaid amount?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. Of course, I would have to see the amendment,
of
but
course.
I don't know that would be an issue for the court if that was part of the bill.
Okay, and I apologize that this just came up over the lunch hour. First time I've seen the bill.
Yes, this bill does get referred to the Finance Committee, and there'll be ample opportunity to consider amendments at that time. Are there any more questions for Mr. Woolover or for Emily Beatley or for Mr. Steiner or Mr. Fink or General Katkus, Representative Cogger?
This would probably go to the sponsor. On page 2, the section 4, it may be just that I've read too much legal language in my life, but I'm having trouble making sense of this. So here we have, the court may grant the petition if the court finds by clearance that the person has substantially complied with other conditions of probation. So far, so good. And continuance of the probation would interfere with the rehabilitation. I don't get that. So they, first of all, you're substantially complying with conditions of probation, and that the person, if you want to put that in there, continuance of the probation would interfere with the rehabilitation and growth of the person. It just seems like we're not saying it right. And so help me understand that. I understand what you mean, but have we said it properly here? I understand if you look at section L at the end, that the person, and then section 4, start the word that the person has substantially complied with other conditions of probation, and that the person, continuance of the probation would interfere with the rehabilitation and growth of the person. Something's wrong with that sentence. And so help me understand how you got to that language.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, we had been in discussions with the Department of Law, and we had added the compliance with other conditions of probation. And in drafting, it seemed that the drafter, Jerry, had combined the two items into one paragraph, where Ms. Carpinetti and I had the conversation earlier, there may need to be a semicolon. I'm not a legal drafter, but there may need to be a semicolon after probation, and a fifth line entered and continuance is, I'm not sure if I'm getting to the heart of your question, if you think they should be separate.
Yeah. So the first requirement is that you've complied with the conditions of probation. The second thing is we don't want anything to interfere with the rehabilitation. But I don't see how we got there. And so it's just a wordsmithing. I'm trying to figure out how to say it. I've gone over this thing a dozen times in my mind. I don't know if there's a semicolon or an if question or what. But I'm working on it, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Samuels?
I'm reticent to jump into an English argument. The way that I've read it is the word substantially. So if you didn't dot every I and cross every T, and the continuance of it to force you down the road of dotting every I and crossing every T, instead you'd say, you know, the best thing for me is to join the service today. So you substantially, but not completely, complied with it. But continuing and forcing you down this road doesn't allow me to join the service, then I should be allowed to join the service. You know, I've gotten most of the probation done, and continuing the probation doesn't do you any good. That's the way that I've read it. And that's the last comments I'll make on the bill, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Just to let you know, I'm going to stumble over that, whether this is the last time I see it or not. I don't suppose. I wouldn't hold it up. I understand what you want to get to. You want to make sure they continue with the probation so that it's not interrupted. I understand that part, but I don't think that's what we've said.
I think it's through the chair. I think what they're saying is two things, that before they can grant the motion, they have to find, number one, that the defendant has substantially complied with any other conditions of probation. In other words, he hasn't been committing any other crimes or something like that. And secondly, they must find that if probation continues and the motion is not granted, that would interfere with the defendant's rehabilitation and growth. I think that that's clear that a court would interpret it that way.
Think so?
Yeah.
All right.
That's how judges think, huh?
No. Who knows?
I'm sorry.
I didn't hear you.
That was a pejorative statement. Strike that off the record.
May I ask, Mr. Willover, isn't that how a court would interpret it?
If you answer that, I'm going to ask
through,
for every bill.
Through the chair.
Sorry.
As just yet another lawyer, I would interpret it that way, but I don't try to guess how courts.
Yeah, but I mean as a lawyer.
Interpret.
Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have an amendment. I just have a question, and my guess is it's not the last time I'll see the bill. So.
Representative Cogill, you don't have an amendment, but Representative Gruenberg has an amendment that's en route.
Okay.
I think the messenger has it, or it's coming. I'd appreciate it, Mr. Chair, if we could take this up towards the end of the meeting.
Yes, and I think Representative Dahlstrom would be happy because she would like to participate in moving this bill. So what I'd like to do, if there's no more questions for public comment, is I'd like to move public comment and then set the bill aside, take up predator control, and then come back and take up youth control.
Thank you.
Sorry. Okay, so with that, public comment is closed on House Bill 359. All right, and Representative Gruenberg has left us. But we still have a quorum with which to... Okay. Thank you. With which to conduct business. And we will make an effort to come back to this bill just before 3 p.m. All right. So
what's next?
With that, we're now going to take up predator control, which is House Bill, the CS for House Bill number 256, the judiciary version. And Representative Samuels, this version E, needs to be adopted. Would you,
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt version of House Bill 256-25-GH1076/E, Kane, as our working document.
I'll object just for one quick question.
Representative Holmes.
Am I correct that the only change between this and the prior version is the effective date, moving it from 07 to 08? That is, in fact, the case, then I'm happy to remove my objection.
I'm
getting nods from the corner of the room.
Okay.
I'm happy to remove my objection. Okay. I believe that that's the only change between the versions. I just wanted to be sure.
So we have the E version before us. We have lost Representative Lynn and Representative Dahlstrom to other committee hearings throughout the building. And the answer in my notes is that yes, the effective date has been changed from July 1, 07 to July 1, 08. We are going to make an effort to limit public testimony, notwithstanding people from the state of Alaska, to 3 minutes. Person that is going to take us through the bill is Senior Assistant Attorney General Kevin Saxby, who wrote the sectional for this bill. Mr. Saxby, are you with us? Yes, Mr. Saxby?
There it is. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
We're so happy to have you before the committee. And if you would take us through the bill, and just before we do, just to give the members a sense of who we have available for testimony after Mr. Saxby takes us through the sectional, we also have Doug Larson with the Division of Wildlife Conservation, and you're with us, Mr. Larson, is that right? Nice to see you. And then online, we have Bill Klutch from the Alaska Professional Hunters, Ruben Hankey, Rod Arno from the Alaska Outdoor Council, some individuals testifying on behalf of themselves out of Anchorage, Wade Willis, Vic Van Ballenberg, and Jerry McCutcheon, a gentleman named Greg Ruxica out of the Bethel LIO. And here in the room, we have as well Joel Bennett, who's with the Alaskans for Wildlife. Welcome, Mr. Bennett. So with that, I think that we will proceed by having Mr. Saxby take us through the bill. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee, Mr. Saxby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did you want me to try to keep it to 3 minutes too, Mr. Chairman?
No, you have all the time in the world.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kevin Saxby. I'm the Senior Assistant AG that's been assigned to the Board of Game and Department of Fish and Game since 1992. And this bill, work on this bill began late in the Murkowski administration when a series of meetings were held with interested legislators. And those meetings culminated in a request to the Departments of Law and Fish and Game to suggest language that would improve and make more workable both the intensive management law and the same-day airborne law. So this bill was begun before the current litigation that we're involved in that challenges Alaska's predator control programs, and before the current initiative that's on the ballot for the next election. The bill has series of sections. The first two sections do not make any substantive changes. They simply adopt conforming language that's necessitated by changes later in the bill. And I guess before I go any further, I'll tell you what our underlying assumptions were here. Both the Department of Fish and Game and Department of Law assumed that the legislature would, the underlying legislative intent was to maintain the intensive management law on the books and to maintain the same day airborne law on the books, but as we were instructed to make them more workable. And so we didn't intend to introduce changes that significantly alter what we believe the underlying core principles of both of those laws are. We simply suggested changes that we think make them work better together. So I've told you about sections 1 and 2. They're not really substantive. Section 3 is where the first set of really substantive changes occur. And this is the beginning of the rewrite of the intensive management law. The underlying principles of the intensive management law we believe are, well, first of all, it needs to be understood by everyone that the intensive management law was originally adopted in 94 as the legislative response to Governor Hickel's 1992 shutdown of predator control in the face of a tourism boycott. So the intensive management law was written originally to force the Board of Game in certain instances to adopt predator control programs. We're assuming that the legislature continues to want to require the board to have a duty to act intensively, to manage intensively in certain instances. And we believe the core principles of that law have always been, first of all, that the board is to identify populations of game that it's important to manage intensively, that are important for high levels of human consumption. Second, that once those populations are identified, that the board set objectives for the size of the population and for the harvest level that's to come out of that population. And third, that the board is then to adopt regulations that implement this duty to manage intensively. And if objectives aren't being met, that the board take what measures are within reason are necessary in order to attempt to reach those objectives. And that's what Section 3 begins. Section 3 restates the duty in a much clearer fashion than it had been stated under the existing law for the board to identify populations that are important to manage for high levels of human use and then to to set objectives, population and harvest objectives for those populations. Section 4 creates the next, or reinforces the next set of duties, which are the duties to adopt regulations that are, and by the way, it's just moose, caribou, and deer populations that we're talking about here, because over the years, since the intensive management law was first passed, the board has gone through and already identified all of the populations that it feels are necessary, or I should say are important to manage for high levels of human use, and it's only some caribou, moose, and deer populations that have been identified. So anyway, Section 4 goes on and says that the board is to manage those populations in order to meet the objectives that it's set. It's to adopt regulations on point. And this is, in a fashion, this is a broader requirement than under current law, because under current law, the board only has to adopt intensive management regulations when a population is depleted or when the board is forced to reduce the taking of that population. Under this new bill, it'll be a duty that is always there. Because once a population is identified as important to manage for high levels of human harvest, it's always important. And sometimes populations need to be reduced, for example, because they're overpopulating their range. And the board needs to have a duty to take action to maintain the productivity of the population in those instances as well. The second part of Section 4 says that if you're not meeting objectives, the board is to adopt regulations to restore productivity and increase harvest, including active management measures and programs. The final section there in Section 4 was added. We didn't put that in. The House Resources Committee put that in, just to emphasize that this duty to identify populations to be managed for high levels of human harvest doesn't mean that you can't identify other uses for populations or identify other populations that are to be managed differently. We didn't see that caused any problems because our feeling was that was already the law anyway.
And what was Chair Gatto's thinking?
It was introduced by Representative Seaton, actually, and as I understood the thinking, he was concerned that the duty that's stated there in Section 3 seems to only consider high levels of human harvest as an important use, and he wanted to make sure that the board would, when appropriate, be able to manage populations for other uses as well.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. You'll notice that we've changed the term intensive management to active management, and in Section 5 then we define that term. Section 5 eliminates a number of the very problematic definitions that are in the current law and that have provided an awful lot of fodder for litigation. So far, the state's prevailed on the statutory interpretation arguments, but it's occupied an awful lot of time, and a lot of those terms are not necessary at all to reach the goals that we think the legislature intended to reach with the intensive management law. But we do keep these two definitions, the one for active management, which if you're able to look at the current law, you'll see that intensive management is defined as active management anyway, so we've just kind of cut out the middleman there. But active management in general carries, in the management community, carries a broader connotation than intensive management. In Alaska, intensive management has come to just equate to predator control. And our intent with this term here is to encourage innovative thinking. There's a number of situations where predator control may not be the answer, but there's still a need to do something beyond just regulating human harvest and bag limits and seasons and do something affirmative. And so we're introducing this term active management to encourage that kind of thinking and to let the public know that is our intent. And then the second
Mr. Saxby, let me interrupt you for a moment. Representative Holmes has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, I'm just looking right here at active management, and since the section's repealed and reenacted, we don't have the old language right in front of us. What was the definition of intensive management?
I'll be happy to read that to you.
Thank you. Just trying to get a change handle.
It's currently in AS 1605-255, subsection J, and then that's subsection 4 of subsection J, and it says, intensive management, in quotes, means management of an identified big game prey population consistent with sustained yield through active management measures to enhance, extend, and develop the population to maintain high levels or provide for higher levels of human harvest, including control of predation and prescribed or planned use of fire and other habitat improvement techniques. So,
Mr. Saxby, Representative Holmes has a follow-up question for you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to get my head around this. So that seemed like a pretty long definition, and now we've gotten rid of that, and we've put in an active management, which appears to be defined just as saying active management includes predator control. Is there a broader definition of active management somewhere else, or is that the only definition?
There certainly could be, and I think if you want to talk to Director Larson, I think we've actually worked on one in anticipating that a legislator might want to broaden that definition. So it could be broader, and we intentionally left it open. You know, I'm sure you know that when the word includes is there, it actually means including but not limited to. There's a statute in Title I that says that. And so we didn't intend to limit active management to predator control, but we wanted to ensure that predator control was in there so that it's clear to the public and to us that the legislature still intends to ratify the use of predator control. But that's a definition that could certainly be expanded if that's where you want to go.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Saxby. If you'll continue, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And I'm sorry, I'll try to go really quickly.
Mr. Saxby, you don't need to hurry. We're doing very well with our time management.
Oh, good. The second definition retains in it almost word for word the current definition of providing for a high level of human harvest, because it's our view that that is the very core of the intensive management principle and the duty that the legislature sought to impose. We've made one small word change there to make it clear that it's the current biological capabilities rather than some future harvestable surplus that's at issue. Sections 6 and 7 do not make substantive changes. They also just make conforming word changes.
Sorry to interrupt you again. For the record, we've lost Representative Holmes to a bill otherwise, but we still are maintaining a quorum. And Representative Gruenberg has a question for you, Mr. Saxby.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not familiar with the bill or fish and game stuff. We don't get into that too much on the committee's ISIP. So I'm be asking some questions ultimately that I'm sure are level one questions rather than level four, where everybody else on the committee is.
Do we have a legal definition of level four?
I don't know enough to do that. You said that the high level of human harvest definition at the bottom of page 2 is a little different but almost the same as the current definition of high level of human harvest. Where is the difference? You could just save me having to read the whole thing.
Yeah, I'm glad to do that. We, let's see. We changed, the current definition says high level of human harvest means the allocation of a sufficient portion of the harvestable surplus, etc. We changed that to say means allowing allocation of a sufficient portion of the harvestable surplus. It seems like a very, very small word change, but it actually bears on an argument that we've been facing in court over time. That argument being, we don't think it's a very, very good argument, I guess, and we've prevailed so far, but the people have argued that the current wording allows or requires that the board try to predict a future harvestable surplus. It's the opposite. The argument is that the board has to base its objectives in setting high levels of human harvest on whatever the current harvestable surplus is, even if that's a depleted harvestable surplus. And our argument has been, no, the purpose of the intensive management law was to restore populations to abundance. And so by this word change, we're changing it to allowing to show that it's a future action rather than a current action.
If I may follow up. Might the use of the term allowing be interpreted to allow the board to do things other than what you're just suggesting? Because it would seem to me, if that's all you wanted to do, you could do it more narrowly to eliminate the possibility of the board doing or not doing things other than what you're contemplating. Do you follow me?
Not quite. I'm at a level 4 or level 1 now.
Okay. Well, just from a legal point of view, the use of the term allowing means that the board may but need not allocate a sufficient portion of the sustainable harvest to achieve a high probability of success. And it sounded to me like what you wanted to do was to do something much more narrow than that. That gives the board a lot more discretion to do other things other than what you just said a moment ago.
The current definition says means the allocation of a sufficient portion. And the argument that we're facing is that means you have to allocate now, currently, based on whatever your current harvestable surplus is. We changed that to allowing to show that this isn't a current allocation, it's something that will happen in the future. But we didn't want to change the overall definition very much because our understanding is that this is it's almost a sacred cow among the folks who are proponents of intensive management, and it's the very core of what the legislature intended to require the board to do.
I understand. What you're saying is that the way some people are interpreting the current language is that the principle must be based on the current number of animals in that particular harvest. And if it's depleted, that would be possibly lower than the board might want to do. I understand that.
Thank you.
But it seems to me that the language just allowing without specifically saying what you're saying might allow the board to do things other or based upon other criteria than just whether you're looking at the denominator being the current level or the proposed level. I just am thinking you're maybe giving the board more discretion here than you're intending.
Well, I guess I don't have suggestions for different language. And I don't think that this definition will... I mean, the underlying principle is still that the board is obligated to manage for high levels of human harvest. So I don't know how the board... I can't off the top of my head think of how the board would be able to, say, twist that into some managing for some other purpose.
Okay, well, I'll pass since I don't know either. The other thing I note is on page 3, line 3 of the bill, you added the word all. In the current language, it says considering hunter demand.
Yes.
Now you say considering all hunter demand. What is the difference, and why did you put the word all in?
Correct. I'm glad you brought that up. It's often a minor point, but it is a change. And what we're making clear here is that the legislature intends the board to manage for all uses, all consumptive uses of a population, not just the local subsistence use. Because the argument has also been made repeatedly in court, again unsuccessfully, but it keeps getting made, that the purpose of the intensive management law must have been only to provide for the often fairly low-level local subsistence use, and it wasn't intended to require management management for abundance in order to provide for, say, urban sport hunters. And we put all in there just so that it's clear. We think that the legislative intent was that management be for all uses, and we're making that clear in the law here to preclude that argument in the future.
If to follow up on that, you just said all uses, but this seems to be limited to hunter uses.
Yeah, all consumptive uses, correct.
Why are you only considering hunter uses?
Because that's the core of the intensive management law. That's what we think the legislature intended to require when it adopted the law in 94. And we weren't commissioned with changing the basic intent of the law. We were just commissioned with making it more workable.
Thank you.
Do you want me to continue, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please, Mr. Saxby.
Section 8 is the next round of substantive changes, and these are the changes to the same-day airborne law. It does several things. It adds brown bears into the same-day airborne law. It doesn't necessarily change the status quo. Brown bears are currently you cannot hunt brown bears on the same-day airborne except in predator control instances. You may be able to take them same-day airborne, but that's all in regulation. There is no statutory language on point. And we thought that if it was important to have statutory language on point for wolves and wolverines, it's equally important for brown bears, because brown bears are a species that's every bit as high-level a keystone predator and slow breeding as, for example, wolverines. So we add them both into the prohibition, and then we add them into the exception. And I guess I should say that our view of the same-day airborne law, the core principles of that law have always been that in whatever iteration it's been, whether you're talking about the Citizens Initiative or the amendments that the legislature's made over the years, there have been two basic principles. One, that in general, that the animals that are covered should not routinely be shot on the same day that a person has been airborne, but that there should be an exception for when that's necessary for some biological purpose. And so we're trying to preserve those two principles here. And this language that is added at the end of the first paragraph, paragraph A of Section 8, changes the existing exception for when it's necessary to mesh it with the intensive management law. This is the first time that the same-day airborne law will actually mesh with the intensive management law as currently worded there, and as worded sometimes in the past, they've been pretty contradictory. And then you can see that we eliminate some of the language that we don't think is necessary to achieve the underlying goals of this law. We get to Section 9, and we add some language in Section 9 that makes it legal for a person who is authorized to say, take a wolf or a brown bear for public safety purposes to fly into a remote area and do so under the current language of the same-day airborne law, it would be illegal for a state employee. He'd be actually committing a misdemeanor if a state employee flew to a remote village and shot a wolf that was harassing school kids or something like that. So we're creating that exception. And then in Section 10, we're defining shooting. Arguments and have been made and questions have been asked about just what shooting, the prohibition on shooting means. Does it mean you can't dart animals? And we're making it clear that you can dart animals. And then sections 11 through 14 are just the transition provisions and the effective date, et cetera. So I hope I haven't taken too much time, but that's a brief overview of what the law does and doesn't do.
Mr. Saxby, it's been very helpful, and as is the custom of this committee, what I'd like to do, Representative Grunberg, is to move to the public testimony component and to keep Mr. Saxby available on the line to come back to us as a reference for us after we get input from those who have boots on the ground. We do have Mr. Larson with us. Mr. Larson, if you'd like to come up and introduce yourself, and I know that you told me that you're available for questions today, so we'd like to keep you handy also as a reference. Do you have any remarks that you'd like to make for the record, or introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Doug Larson. I'm the director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation at Fish and Game. Mr. Saxby, I think, has done a very nice job of going through the bill with you. I don't want to take up more of your time at this point, but I certainly will be here to answer questions if you have any of a biological nature.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Larson. Are there any questions for Mr. Larson while we have him? Okay, very good. I think at this point, thank you, Mr. Larson.
Are you with the department?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Fish and Game?
Yes.
I think at this point, Mr. Bennett is in the room. We'd invite you up, Mr. Bennett, to offer testimony. And as I say, we're going to limit testimony to 3 minutes, and the chair and the committee will reserve the right to bring back anybody who offered a particularly engaging testimony for a follow-up. Mr. Bennett, welcome to House Judiciary Committee. Thank you for joining us and offering your input for the public record. If you would state your name and any affiliation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joel Bennett. I represent Alaskans for Wildlife. This is the committee that's sponsoring and promoting the initiative that will be voted on by Alaskans in August.
What is the initiative? I've caught fleeting bits of it in the paper.
It's 90 days.
No, it's not about cruise ships. It's not about limiting the session. It's about same-day airborne hunting. It's called the 05 Hunt Initiative.
I can make a suggestion. That microphone is way, way too close for me. I think it's breaking up and probably not helping our transcriber.
Thank you, Representative Coghill. If you could just go through what the nature of the initiative is, just very briefly.
Okay. Well, the initiative is substantially the same as the initiative that passed in 1996.
We can hear you fine.
Which
we can hear you fine.
Was largely repealed through actions by the legislature 3 years after that. Subsequent to that, we brought another initiative or a referendum in 2000 dealing with one of the main aspects of the previous initiative, that is to say whether or not the public or department personnel would be the people who would undertake airborne predator control, and that passed as well in the year 2000. So, unfortunately, that was also repealed after 2 years by legislative action. So here we are back again in 2008 with the third initiative, which essentially tracks the language of the first initiative. But I should point out to the committee that it deals entirely with the section that's contained in this HB 256, that is Section 8. And that is the same-day airborne hunting statute that exists now.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bennett. Feel free to commence with your testimony. Thank you for the background.
Okay, I for members of the committee, just a brief background. Next year will be my 40th year of residency. I served on the Board of Game for over 12 years, and as I mentioned, I've been involved in each one of these initiatives since 1996. I testified at the House Resources Committee against HB 256 in general because it does not meet, in my view, any of the threshold standards that's contained in the initiative, either of the original one or the one coming up. However, today I think I'd like to focus on just on Section 8 and just on one aspect of Section 8, because this is really the most important thing, I think, for the committee to understand and answer at this point. As you are probably aware, the Lieutenant Governor, with the assistance of the Attorney General, can take an initiative off the ballot when the legislature enacts a statute that's substantially similar. It's clear from this statute that the Office of the Attorney General has a critical role to play in determining whether Section 8 of this proposed bill and the initiative are substantially the same. Yet, at the Senate Resources Committee hearing on the companion bill to this bill, SB 176, we heard the Assistant Attorney General representing the department and the Board of Game declined to answer the question about whether Section 8 of this bill is substantially similar to the ballot initiative. Instead, he vaguely stated that the bill should just stand or fall on its own merits. This forces us to assume that the department and the Department of Law are being evasive with you and with the public. It forces us to assume that they want to avoid saying whether Section 8 of the bill is substantially similar because they know that it will cause a serious reaction from the 57,000 people who signed this initiative over the past year, which is why it's certified to be on the ballot now. Once this bill passes, perhaps, then they will tell the Lieutenant Governor that the bill is substantially the same and ask him to remove the initiative from the ballot. Let me emphasize that as one of the sponsors of the initiative, I don't think Section 8 is substantially the same as the initiative. Any common sense and plain reading of the two documents, I think, would reach that conclusion. However,
Mr. Bennett, if you can try and reach a conclusion, okay. I appreciate it.
The goal of the initiative is to revise the current law so it is nearly the same as the initiative that was passed in 96. The key part of that is a biological emergency. As you can see in Section 8 of HB 266, there's no mention of a biological emergency. To demonstrate how dissimilar it is, all you have to do is look at what's happened this year and last year and the previous 2 years. The board adopted 5 predator control programs for killing large numbers of wolves on tens of thousands of acres of state and federal lands. Not a single one of these programs would satisfy the initiative standard. Every single one would, however, would satisfy the vague standards in Section 8. Maybe some of you disagree with me and think that Section 8 is substantially similar to the initiative. Many of your constituents will want to know that before you vote on this bill. If you are not sure, before you vote, I ask that you require the Department of Law to give you its best advice on that question and otherwise tell you what it will advise the Lieutenant Governor should Section 8 pass. We don't want to be tricked, and neither should you, and certainly the public deserves a fair and open discussion of this point. I think the only way that you can assure that doesn't happen is to debate the substantially similar question openly with the best advice you can get from the Department of Law on this issue. It's not about predator control. It's not about airborne hunting. It's about democracy. Without a critical analysis, by passing this bill out with Section 8 as written, you could be denying the people of Alaska their right to vote.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions for Mr. Bennett? Representative Coghill?
Mr. Bennett, are you involved in litigation with regard to the initiatives?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Bennett, thank you very much for coming before the committee. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Can I ask a question to the chair?
Yes.
Since this is a little bit of an unusual bill before it come before this committee, mm-hmm. Were there any kind of parameters put on what they wanted us to look at in the bill?
None that I'm aware of, but I would defer to the rules chairman.
I'm wondering why it got referred to us.
Good question. I don't know. I wasn't in on the discussion.
Nor did we request it. So this was in the ordinary referral.
Are there any unusual legal issues? Maybe I should ask Mr. Saxby, or I'm just wondering, since you want to move the bill, if there's something we should be specifically looking at.
Representative Coghill?
And I think maybe the question I just asked him probably was, I was looking for that same answer. Since this is part of a debate between those who have a public initiative, votes mm-hmm. of the people, and a different legislature, that's probably the reason it got here, but I was not involved in the discussion as to the referral.
Maybe I should say this to the leadership. I hope that's not a precedent, because I don't think we need, every time there's a conflict between an initiative and a previous legislature, to have a judiciary look at. We've got a lot of stuff on our plate. And I know that this is an issue that a lot of people are interested on both sides of the issue. Just as a question, because I wasn't here at the end.
Thank you for your input. I think next we'll go to Joe Clutch with the Alaska Professional Hunters. Mr. Clutch, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you are.
Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself and any affiliation, if you'd limit your remarks to 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Clutch. I currently serve as president of Alaska Professional Hunters Association, and I'm here to speak on behalf of our hunting guide members as well as myself. After nearly 40 years of living in rural Alaska, and I've hunted in the Brooks Range and the Wrangells and traveled this state widely and very familiar with the big game species of this state, I'll trust you consider my comments carefully. Now, there's a great hunting tradition in our state, and I thought it was exceptionally well stated in the ADF&G publication, Predator Management in Alaska, quote, it is integral to our lifestyles, traditional cultures, the economy, and basic food needs for many Alaskan families. And I'd add that a lot of those families are guiding families who share substantial amounts of meat with people who would otherwise not have access to wild game. The issue at hand is the dwindling number of moose, caribou, and in some areas deer and other ungulate species that's occurred over the last 15 years. Again, the publication Predation Management in Alaska reviews the history going back to territorial days and through early statehood. It's quite an interesting publication, and important for you to read that. most of these declines can be directly attributable to ever-increasing number of predators, particularly wolves, especially in western and south-central Alaska. Historically active predator management resulted in high numbers of game species, allowing for sustainable, long-term use by hunters. Since the 1980s, efforts to manage predator numbers has been curtailed, the result being continual loss of opportunity. Opponents of this bill would like you to believe that no predator control efforts should be undertaken until a threshold of biological emergency. And members of the committee, I think this is the critical point in this. It's just not acceptable to allow populations to be depleted by predation or overhunting or any other activity to a level of biological emergency. It intentionally ignores the fact that at that point in the allocation equation, non-resident, general resident seasons are closed, and in most cases, subsistence seasons are curtailed to Tier 1 or Tier 2, where there aren't enough animals to allow for a sustainable harvest. Allowing this to occur, we find many of our game species in the proverbial predator pit where recovery may take decades. We have a constitutional and even a moral obligation not to allow this to happen. I've sat on a Fish and Game Advisory Committee here for 28 years and watched systematically seasons of caribou and moose be closed and had to vote in favor of that, and in many instances due to the increase particularly of wolf populations. Nothing in this legislation spells doom for predators. To the contrary, it gives ADF&G, the Board of Game, with thorough public input from all affected parties, the ability to authorize and undertake properly justified and measured predator management programs. It allows us to act before we find ourselves in a management crisis. Acting only in the case of a biological emergency is acting too late. Failure to actively manage predator species, particularly wolves, is and will continue to have a devastating effect on all Alaskans who rely on prey species. And that includes watchable wildlife folks and people that don't even make it out to the wilderness, that, as they say, just get off on knowing they're there.
Mr. Clutch, if you could try.
Everybody can benefit by including predators in a management equation. In conclusion, I urge you to do what is right and move this legislation on to passage. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Clutch? Representative Coghill?
Just from the hunter's point of view, it's my understanding that the predators get the vast majority of this population is going to be controlled under this bill. Do you have, from your profession, what percentage you might take for human consumption over against what predators take for consumption? Or should I refer that to the department?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, it varies from population to population. In terms of moose populations in Game Management Unit 17 and Unit 9, human population will account, or human harvest can account for less than 2%, 3% of the entire attrition in a population. Predation can be as high as 60 to 80%, particularly calves and cows with calves are especially vulnerable to both bears and wolves, but primarily wolves. At least that's what I'm seeing here. But this is the job of the Board of Game and the Department of Fish and Game and good public input to sort this out on a case-by-case, unit-by-unit, proposed regulation-by-regulation basis. I don't see anything in this legislation that is a wholesale authorization to go out there and eliminate predators. That's not the intent of this bill.
I just, thanks for the perspective, and I guess we'll talk to the Fish and Game people about the matrix of the areas. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clutch. Can we go now to John Toppenberg in Soldotna with the Alaska Wildlife Alliance? If you'd introduce yourself and any affiliation that you have, Mr. Toppenberg.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you. I'm John Toppenberg, director of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. I'd like to address just one aspect of this bill, specifically the abdication of any requirement that available biological science be a part of the decision-making process. Please note that we disagree with Mr. Saxby's interpretation of much of HB 1256 as it applies to this specific. Clearly, the Board of Game often gives a minimal consideration to available science, although sometimes they do. I do acknowledge that. The Board of Game has implemented predator control programs that cause mainstream scientists serious concern. Note that research data compiled by ADF&G is available to any interested scientists. Scientific organizations opposed to the current extreme predator control programs include the National Research Council, the American Society of Mammalogists, who comprise 500 scientists that signed off on two different letters to the governor, and a letter I delivered to the governor signed by 172 scientists from both inside and outside of Alaska, making it clear that they see a little scientific justification for the extreme predator control programs now in place. This bill would not only eliminate the requirement to consider the minimal scientific information normally brought to the bog, but this regressive bill eliminates even the requirement that predators are the proximate cause of possible lowered numbers of prey. Now, this legislation should be opposed by anyone supporting modern kinds concepts of wildlife management, which recognize that healthy populations of both predator and prey are necessary for healthy ecosystems here in Alaska. Thank you, gentlemen.
Chairman. Thank you very much, Mr. Toppenberg. Representative Coghill?
Thank you. In your science review, did you do it with regard to just the management of the population or management for human consumption of these populations?
These assessments, as I interpret them and understand them, would be a notation that the Board of Game has implemented inadequate justification or given inadequate justification for the extreme nature of the predator control programs now in place, irregardless of whether they are structured for consumptive or non-consumptive use. It's simply an acknowledgement that modern scientific concepts are not a part of the decision-making process and should be.
And Mr. Chairman, that is a non-scientific answer, and I just won't accept it. Sorry.
I didn't hear the last of that.
I just can't accept that as a scientific answer. I asked you, was it with regard to human consumption or just the ecosystem, and I didn't get the answer.
Well, I think the interpretation there would be that these scientists believe that it is in the best interest of both predator and prey to have healthy ecosystems, and that our predators are a necessary part of healthy, intact, functioning ecosystems, and that severe, extreme depletion of predator numbers such as 80%, which is now a stated goal of wolf reduction in five areas of the state, is so extreme it does not meet any currently accepted scientific standards.
All right. Thank you for your point of view, Mr. Toppenberg. Next we'll go to Reuben Hanke. Reuben, are you with us?
Yeah. Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
We hear you loud and clear, Reuben. If you'd introduce yourself and any affiliation or whether you're just speaking for yourself today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Reuben Hanke. I live in Soldotna, Alaska, and I'm representing myself today. I would also like to say that I hold a current aerial wolf control gunner's permit. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm here today to speak in favor of HB 256. Since we started the aerial wolf control project in Game Management Unit 16B, I have personally noticed an increase in the numbers of moose that are present in a small area that I hunt and trap. This area would be from the Drift River to Beluga Lake, if any of you are familiar with that. It's about 30 air miles long and about 20 air miles wide. Prior to 2005, we used to fly into this area to trap, and on the way out, we'd look for moose. We would typically count about 20 to 40 moose, usually in one area in front of the Big River Lakes area, and very seldom see calves of the year. Since 2005, I've noticed a substantial increase in the numbers of moose. I am seeing moose in several different areas other than the one spot in front of Big River Lakes, and the number of calves has increased dramatically. I realize that Game Management Unit 16 still has problems with moose numbers overall, but I believe if we continue to move forward with the existing program that we will see an increase throughout the unit. I believe that HB 256 will help us get there. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to speak today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Reuben. It's always good to have you testify before our committees on any subject. You're well respected and always well received down here. Are there any questions for Reuben? All right, seeing none, we thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Wade Willis in Anchorage. Mr. Willis, are you with us?
Here I am.
Hi, Mr. Willis. If you'll introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair, and committee members for taking the time to hear my testimony. My name is Wade Willis. I live in Anchorage. I have a degree in biology, a past biologist for the fish and game. I now own an outfitter business, and I'm an avid moose hunter. I'm continually amazed at the biased testimony you guys are receiving from the Board of, or from the Department of Law and the Fish and Game. They intentionally omit serious consequences of this bill. And basically, they don't want you to know that they are removing any requirements to use science to document whether or not predator control is necessary. They're giving a carte blanche open ticket to the Board of Game to use their opinion to institute one of the most contentious issues that face wildlife management in this state. Three public initiatives have put this forward. The people of this state have voted. They have given clear indication of how they feel about aerial predator control. They definitely want science involved. This bill removes the words need for science completely. It allows the Board of Game to have an opinion, and that's it, and not justify whether or not that opinion is reality or not. This bill clearly, well, let's say, you know, the Board of Game is mandated to manage Alaska's wildlife for the benefit of all Alaska residents. As the Judiciary Committee, you're responsible for making sure bills that pass through your committee propagate that mandate. How do you justify this bill that gives unfettered access to the most contentious wildlife management issue to the Board of Game that is composed of 15% of the population of this state? 15% of the population of this state hunts. 85% of this population does not. This bill removes even further the ability of that 85% of the state to have a say in how the wildlife is managed in this state. It's unbelievable. You don't improve the statute by replacing science with opinion. And you don't improve the statute by legislating the public out of the process. For the first time, this bill wants to include aerial gunning of bears. Now, if the public has been so vocal in its wording of how they want to handle predator wolf control, what do you think the public's going to do when you try to do it to bears, too? It's just unbelievable. The legislature should never hand such a contentious issue over to a special interest group, which that's what the Board of Game is. It does not represent all of Alaskans. It has not attempted to include all of Alaska residents. It's not attempted to put all user groups at the table. So it's crazy to remove any oversight to the Board of Game in enacting this predator control.
Mr. Willis, can you try and conclude your remarks, please?
I sure can, yeah. So this bill is just attempting to legislate the public out of the process. The Judicial Committee is mandated to make sure the bills that pass through this committee uphold the public's ability to be involved in the process. This bill destroys that. And I would really like you to ask the Department of Law to clarify why science needs to be removed from the equation to improve the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. So your contention is that science has been removed from this piece of legislation and the public process has been removed from this piece of legislation. Is that correct?
I'm not contending. You can directly ask the board, the Department of Law. They have removed the specific words that say need to base predator management on the best science available. They've removed it. They didn't clean it up. They didn't change it. They removed it. They removed it and replaced it with the opinion of the Board of Game. So yes, I do believe that the public is being denied the ability to interact with the Board of Game, because basically what recourse does the public have when the only mandate the board has is to have an opinion? That's just amazing. That's amazing that you would only require an opinion for such a contentious issue.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any other questions for Mr. Willis? All right, seeing none, we thank you very much for your insightful testimony, Mr. Willis.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Can we go to Rod Arno with the Alaska Outdoor Council? And for the benefit of the members, in case you haven't noticed, we've tried to go back and forth from those that are for and against to try and present a balanced picture of how this legislation is perceived by the public during the public testimony process. Mr. Arno, if you'd introduce yourself and any affiliation that you have for the record, please.
Yes, Chairman Ramirez. My name is Rod Arno. I'm Executive Director of the Alaska Outdoor Council, statewide organization. Council's collective membership is 3,000 individual members and 47 clubs. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, after watching this intensive management bill through the legislature as a representative of the Outdoor Council and watching it implemented before the Board of Game since its conception, I've got good news. And the good news is that our state government is doing something right and doing it for the right reasons. What they're doing is successfully managing our predator-prey relationships on a limited area of the state, less than 10%. And the reason they're doing it is to allow for the continuation of our traditional cultural wild food harvest. Since the law was passed in 94 that empowered our professional wildlife managers to implement predator control management programs, there's been a number of legal challenges by outside or outside-funded animal rights groups. The state has prevailed in every single case so far. While their record is commendable, it has taken a considerable amount of state time, money, and brain power. So now our state employees have done what has been reasonably expected them to do. They've taken a look back. They've seen what could be done to tighten up the law as it was amended throughout the years and have offered those improvements to you in the form of HB 256. Mr. Chairman, when the Department of Fish and Game appears off their mission, AOC is quick to jump on them on that. But in this case, when they're doing something right, we should support them and give them the tools they need to do the job we ask them to do. Pass this bill from committee and clean up the law. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Arno. Representative Coghill has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Arno. And I think I'm beginning to understand why this got to the Judiciary Committee, because we end up resting on a constitutional principle here. But from your perspective, the last caller talked about science and the department excusing itself from science. Even though I may have disagreed with him, he brought a very, very strong argument. Is that a concern to the Outdoor Council with regard to good science?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, no, sir. That we are clear what ADF&G's mission statement is. We've just gone through this with the department, the division actually of Habitat, transferring it from DNR because they have a different mission statement. ADF&G's mission statement, it remains the same, and that is to protect, maintain, and improve the fish and game and aquatic plants resources of the state, and to manage their use and development in the best interest of the economy and the well-being of the people of the state, consistent with the sustained yield principle. This mission statement of the department does not go away. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Coghill.
And Mr. Arno, from your perspective then, the fish and game people have, in fact, been collecting data and making decisions based on good science?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, absolutely. And I think the best collection of that, hopefully the department has passed out their copy of the predator management in Alaska that they just prepared for informing the public here this last November. And in that, in the resource section, there's over 60 references, and Alaska right now has the most knowledgeable predator-prey management scientists in the world, from Ballard, McNay, Gardner, Borgie, Valkenburg, Gassaway, Keish, Tom Paraguay, Teste. You know, the Don Young. There is a considerable amount of information that, fortunately, with the appropriations that we've been able to get out of the legislature, that have allowed these expert scientists to gather information to the level and depth that they have on these current five programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Arnold, thank you very much for your input today. Next, if we can go to Jerry McCutcheon, please, in Anchorage.
I guess I'm on the air. I can't tell here for sure.
We can hear you, Mr. McCutcheon.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jerry McCutcheon, M-C, capital C-U-T-C-H-E-O-N. A statement about biological science. Biological science is not science. Biological science is not science. It's an art like medicine. There's a great big difference. Thank you. I like to get that straight. Gone are the days of Bellamer Brown, Archdeacon Stuck, when great herds of caribou and bands of sheep roamed the foothills of Mount McKinley. The bands of sheep so numerous and thick that they would not move out of the way of the oncoming dog teams of the miners, trappers, and post office mail dog team drivers. Sheep immediately in front of the dogs would just jump up in the backs of other sheep and then fold back in as the dog teams passed through. Imagine a dog team totally surrounded by sheep, moving through the sheep with the sheep immediately in front of the dogs, jumping up on the backs of the other sheep to get out of the way, then closing in behind the dogs as the dogs move through the sheep. It was a spectacular sight, but I never got to see it, nor will anyone else. Senator Carl Wattsfeld, who is postal mail dog team driver and later miner, every time we were in a bar together after a Democratic luncheon, would insist on telling me that the trail on which the dog races were held, called Iditarod, were not held where the real Iditarod trail. The real Iditarod trail went through Mount McKinley Park. I've heard identical stories from other old-time miners and trappers. The Park Service took out hunting and trapping in the equation. Wolves slowly destroyed the big bands of caribou and sheep to the point there was little or nothing left. Wolves resorted to killing each and eating each other and left the park where there was still game because the territory then the state practiced hunting wolves from airplanes. There were more wolves, more game when the wolves were airily hunted back years ago. Back years ago, just before they managed to close off aerial wolf hunting, it was the wolves 4, pilots none, wrecked 4 airplanes, killed 2 people, injured 2 people, and no wolves were taken. I'm a firm believer in aerial wolf hunts. None of this land and shoot crap. It's not about fair chase. It's about predator control. No wolf hunting or bear hunting by ADF&G or relocating animals by ADF&G. Just raise a bounty until the state has an active community of aerial wolf hunters. Thank you.
Mr. McCutcheon, how long have you been in Alaska for?
Oh, how about 76 years.
You know, there is, regardless of which side of this issue on, there is no substitute for colorful testimony. There is nothing like sourdough that has been here forever. My dad is closing in on 60 years here, and it sure is a pleasure to get you guys with wisdom in a room to tell it like it really is.
Mr. Chairman, there are some that have been saying around here, well, they can remember when so-and-so on the other side who can remember so-and-so. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm barely old enough to remember to have dealt with those people. I don't know how these other ones who are 30 and 40 years younger than I am could have ever possibly met them. They were in their graves by that time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. I wish Jack Coghill was here to respond to that, by God. Put that in there. So, Mr. McCutcheon, thank you very much for your testimony, and it's greatly appreciated by this committee that you would take time to share your point of view with us. Finally, can we go to Vic Van Ballenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Vic Van Ballenberg, and
I've been in Alaska 132 years. I never was good at math. I guess it's only about 34 years. I'm a professional wildlife biologist. I've been doing work here as a biologist since 1974. And I also served three different times on the game board, 1985 to 88, 96, and 2002. Mr. Chair, the core issue before you here, I believe, is what is contained in HB 256 versus what the current statutes, the intensive management law and the same-day airborne hunting law contain, and what changes are mandated to the existing regulations or existing statutes by SB 176 and HB 256. In order to determine that, you need to just set those three things side by side and go back and forth. And if you do that, you will find that Section 3 of HB 256 deletes from the intensive management statute that now exists paragraph E, and that provides several constraints or guidelines that the Board of Game uses when it adopts intensive management regulations. One of those is that intensive management applies only to depleted moose and caribou populations or those that have reduced productivity. And the original language that was put in the bill by previous legislators and legislatures after careful consideration was put there for a reason. Now we are changing the rules of the game to apply intensive management to not only depleted populations, but to any population if HB 256 passes. That's a significant change. Section 3 also deletes the provision in existing law that intensive management programs must be feasibly achievable using recognized and prudent active management techniques. Why would we want to delete that? Why would we want to delete the provision that intensive management programs do not apply if they are ineffective, inappropriate, or against the best interest of subsistence users? That is deleted by Section 4 in HB 256. The most serious provisions that are deleted are in Section 8 that deals with the same-day airborne shooting law that now exists. Those provisions would delete the guideline to the board that based on information from the Department of Fish and Game, the board must find that predation is a cause for the problems and a likely solution if predator control is a likely solution if, in fact, predation is the cause. Isn't it just common sense that before we launch a wolf control program, we'd want to establish that predation is the problem and reducing it is the cause, is the solution? And so the question is, why does HB 256 delete that phrase? You were told about a half an hour ago by Mr. Saxby that it's just unnecessary language, just simply unnecessary language. And I would propose that it is far from unnecessary language. It's an important guideline for the board that every single professional biologist that I know who's competent would object to having that language taken out of this bill. In summary, Mr. Chairman, you have been told that that this bill is an improvement to the existing statutes, that it would make things more workable, and it's also been billed in previous hearings as simplifying the existing statutes. I propose to you that it goes far beyond those things. It removes virtually all the guidelines that the board has when it adopts intensive management programs, and it replaces them with the simple requirement that what the board passes must be conducive, repeat, conducive to achieving the intensive management objectives. That standard is so weak as to be meaningless. Why does it appear there at all? Why isn't there Why is there any guideline if that's all there is to it? So I urge you to look carefully at this, to look carefully at what's taken out of the existing statutes and what they are replaced with. And at a minimum, Mr. Chairman, I would strongly urge you to amend the bill to restore the language in Section 8 that is deleted, and specifically that's page 4, lines 25 to 31, and page 5, lines 1 to 8. I strongly urge you to amend the bill to restore that deleted language. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van Ballenberg. Are there questions? Seeing none, you have a question, Representative Groenberg?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I've been a little distracted, sir, and the other testimonies. You want to see an amendment to restore. Can you give me statutory cites?
That would be page 4 in section 8, page 4, lines 25 to 31, and on the next page, 5, lines 1 through 8. That is the language that is proposed to be deleted from the current version of the Same-Day Airborne Hunting Act.
So you would like that language left in?
Absolutely, sir. That language is critical to guiding the board in making some important determinations before it adopts a predator control program. And those determinations are, is predation the problem, and is reducing predation the solution? And again, it's just common sense that the board would want to make that determination critically based on information from the department, which is the entity that gathers the biological information. The board doesn't gather that information. It's the Department of Fish and Game biologists that gather it. Why would we want to delete that provision? That's critical to having a regulation related to predator control that will work in the long run. And deleting that language, depriving the board of that guideline, is a major mistake.
Mr. Van Ballenberg, through the chair, I assume then you would want to delete the new language at the end of line 20 and going through line 24, because that's new language. So we would take that out and keep the current language in, right?
That is correct. That would be the essence of what I'm recommending, to keep the provision that, based on information provided by the Department of Fish and Game, that the board determines that, one, predation is the problem, and two, reducing predation is the solution.
A second question, and this all goes to Section 8, if I may, through the chair.
Representative Groenberg.
Do you have problems with adding brown bears?
To be frank, yes, I do. I mean, this is precedent setting. Brown bears in the state of Alaska have been considered a trophy species, a big game trophy species, since statehood, since the legislature set up the basic authorities and functions of the Department of Fish and Game. In recent years, they have become predators, and the existing statute, the existing intensive management statute, fully allows the board to have predator control programs that are designed to reduce bear predation and bear populations when that is the problem.
Mr. Van Ballenberg, what year were brown bears, did they become predators?
The research started coming in the late 1970s that brown bears were a significant predator of moose calves and caribou calves. But again, my point is that the existing intensive management law gives the board all the authority it needs to reduce brown bears when they are in fact documented to be a predator. And we need not consider the drastic measure of shooting them from the air. I mean, of all the, that was proposed once by the game board. They adopted a regulation to that effect. I believe it was 1982. And overnight, there was such public resistance to that the next day they rescinded it under huge amounts of pressure. You know, the concept of the vision of shooting brown bears from the air is just so repulsive to most folks that it should not fly.
Mr. Chair.
That was a remarkably subjective answer. I appreciate your candor. Representative Grunberg.
I'm going over the other two things in this Section 8, too. Lines 18 to 19, they delete as part of a game management plan, and that's in quotes. Do you believe that language should be restored, and if so, why?
Yes, through the chair, yes, sir, I do. I didn't have time to get to that. Again, you know, why should we object to having the provision, the guideline for the game board, when it adopts predator control programs, that they be part of a game management plan? Again, you know, most biologists and managers would applaud that. There must be overriding considerations that guide these actions, and what better way than to put them in a plan, a game management plan, of which predator control is a part. It's a puzzle to me why that would be taken from the existing statute, other than, as has been suggested, it is one of the issues on which the litigation has been based. My response to that whole strategy of taking this list of things out of existing statutes on which the litigation has been based is well, you know, why don't we say, rather than doing that at this great cost, in other words, the cost of depriving the game board of these existing guidelines, rather than doing that, why don't we ensure that the board follows the existing statute? It's not that complex, and as you have heard in testimony today, when it has been challenged, the state has prevailed. So what's the issue?
Okay, to the chair, one final question. On line 17, they deleted the word A and inserted the word the. What do you think about that change?
What page would that be, sir?
All on page 4. We're on Section 8. I'm going over everything in Section 8 with you. And that's the last change I see. It says, on the same day that originally a person has been airborne, and now it says the same day that the person has been airborne. Do you see that as a good change or a bad change, or are you neutral on that?
I think that's fine. I don't see any problem with that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Van Vollenberg. We appreciate your point of view. At this time, do we have anybody else in the room or online that would like to testify? Mr. Larson, is there anybody else? No? Mr. Larson, are there any questions for Mr. Larson? Representative Grunberg?
Say again. I'm sorry.
Do you have any questions for Mr. Larson?
No.
Any other members of the committee? Mr. Saxby, are you still on the line?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right, so at this point, I'm going to close public testimony. I'm going to hold Mr. Saxby on the line to continue to go through the bill with us since he was the drafter. Is that acceptable, Mr. Gruber?
Yeah, I have one question if I could ask.
You got it.
Okay, Mr. Saxby, I had asked earlier why the bill came to judiciary, and I'm just wondering if you could pinpoint us as to any legal issues you see that we should specifically address.
Mr. Chairman, I honestly don't know why it came to judiciary. The legal issues, I think, have already been thrashed out. I think you've heard everything that every other committee member previously has heard now on the arguments pro and con.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If I may, I think that if we refer to Article 8 in the Constitution, sustained yield, fish, forests, wildlife, grasslands, and all other replenishable resources belonging to the state shall be utilized, developed, and maintained on the sustained yield principle, subject to preferences among beneficial uses. Thank you. At this point, we're going to close public testimony, and we will bring the matter back before the committee. Mr. Saxby is on the line to help us with any questions or issues that we have with regard to the bill. What are the wishes of the committee? Representative Gruenberg?
Yeah, I'm going to offer an amendment, and this relates to what Mr. Bennett and Mr. Von Valkenburg said. Mm-hmm. I hope I got your name right, sir. And I would like to, with respect to Section 8, mm-hmm. the only change I want is conceptual. The only change I want to make in the existing AS 1605783A would be on line 17 of page 4 to change a person to the person.
Okay.
Other than that, there would be no change to the existing statute. That is my conceptual amendment. And for the reasons that have been stated, I don't need to argue them.
All right, we have conceptual amendment number one before us. Is there an objection?
Object.
Representative Samuels objects. For the purpose of discussion?
I knew he was going to do that.
I think
Mr. Saxby did it, but we've been talking
Mr. Saxby, can you take us through the difference between the word the on line 17 of page 4 and the deleted word a?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Read literally, if we leave a in there, a person could not shoot or assist in shooting free-ranging wolf or wolverine on the same day that a person, that would be any person, has been airborne. We changed it to the to make it clear that it had to be the same person that we were talking about.
Well, I guess I Representative Samuels?
It's my understanding that the amendment offered by Representative Gruenberg was going to eliminate Section 8 of the bill except for that change.
Yes, sir. So I do want to make that change that Mr. Saxby just discussed. I support that change to existing law, as Mr. Von Dahlenberg has done. Other than that, I don't want to see any change to that existing statute.
I could do this. I could, Mr.
Representative Samuels?
Do this in two parts. Eliminate Section 8, and if that vote wins, then go back and change the to A. If the elimination of Section 8 of the bill doesn't change, then you already get A to B.
I was just thinking I could do it in one amendment rather than two.
Okay.
We're under discussion. So
I mean, if you it really makes a difference, I'll do it that way. I just thought it'd be simpler to keep, you know, so they would not have any of the underlined or highlighted language. The only change to existing law would be that one word change.
Would you go over the amendment again, please, Representative Gruenberg?
Sure.
This is conceptual amendment number one.
Just a second. Okay. What it would do with respect to AS 1605783A would be keep the statute as it is currently on the books, making no changes to it.
In version
except
E?
Except for the one word. On line 17, we would change A to the. Otherwise, no change to existing law. So in other words, we're not adding brown bears. We're not adding the underlined language in bold on
Understood.
Lines 20 through 24. We're leaving in the language that would be deleted on lines 25, page 4, through page 5, line 8.
Quite clear. The objection is maintained.
Yes.
Susan, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
No.
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Samuels.
No.
Representative Lynn is not present. Representative Holmes is not present. Representative Rammers.
No.
One yes, four no.
The conceptual amendment number one fails. Are there other amendments before the committee? Representative Grunberg?
No.
Are there any other amendments before the committee? All right, we have the CS for House Bill number 256, version E, before us. At this point, the matter is before the committee in its amended form. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would propose that we move the CS for House Bill number 256, version E, with attached physical note and individual recommendations.
Is there an objection? Seeing none, House Bill 256 passes from the Judiciary Committee. And now, if we can, we will return to House Bill 359. Do the members have the amendment marked OK up in the upper right-hand corner?
I'm not sure I do. Do I?
M.1?
I don't seem to have my amendments.
Would you like some more?
Oh, thank you. And now I do. Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Okay. I have two amendments here.
Thank you, Mr. Larson, for spending the afternoon with us.
Let me just do this. Yes. Can I just have a moment to sign this?
Mr. Bennett, thank you for spending the afternoon with us. I appreciate your passion and respect you for it.
Okay. The first one, if I may, through the chair,
Representative Grunberg,
I'd like to offer is the one labeled M1. If we could label that amendment number one. And I would offer the amendment, and if somebody would object, then I could explain it.
I will object, recognizing that it's good to have you back, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. This does what I discussed earlier, which not only requires a good faith effort to pay, but that they must agree to have the debt reduced to civil judgment and enter into a repayment plan and agree that the civil judgment may be enforced in the manner provided by statute for restitutions and fines. It looks good to me. I think Mr. Lockup did a very good job. And I am authorized to say that Mr. Woolover, at first glance, does not see a problem with it, reserving the right to have the courts look at it as the bill moves through. And I would ask unanimous consent for the amendment.
Is the objection to amendment number one maintained?
You objected.
I will remove my objection. Did you get that?
Never let it be said didn't get anything through this committee.
Oh, yeah. No. Representative Grunberg, I would suggest that you get all your good amendments through this committee.
That they have a broad basis of support. That's certainly true.
Representative Grunberg.
The other amendment is a title amendment, M2, and if we could label that title amendment number two.
Susan, do you have these?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And if I could offer it, if somebody could object for a discussion.
I would be delighted to object, Representative Grimmer.
Thank you. And again, this is a little bit at the call of the chair. I didn't bring it up before because I didn't know what it would come out. I had talked to staff about it. I'm concerned as a potential person who likes to amend things that as bills go through, if we're not careful in this 90-day session, people will try to attach all kinds of things to good bills like this. And this ratchets it down, so it will keep it in your control as to whether you want things attached rather than having to try to keep them out, frankly.
Excellent point, Representative Grunberg.
And I would hope that we could have unanimous consent on the title amendment.
Does that come under the heading that takes one to no one?
Yeah, it does. I'll live by the sword and die by the sword, yeah.
Yes, I will remove my objection to amendment number two. Do you have any other amendments for us?
No, I'm prepared to make a motion unless...
Fine work. Representative Grunberg.
Move the bill with individual recs.
Thank you.
The House Bill 359, version M. Is that correct?
Version M.
Okay.
Yep.
Susan, do you have that? Mm-hmm. And pending fiscal note, and we'll see how that goes with the court system. All right. I see that it is 2 minutes before 3 o'clock. The final piece of business that was to be before the committee today was House Bill 237. Representative Gruenberg, this was a courtesy to you when you were recovering.
And, thank you. You needed very much
incentive to return to the legislature. And now that you're well, of course, my incentive program is wilted some, but I'm still there for you. I'm still there.
Do you want me to make to talk on that for a minute?
Yes, but I just wanted to bring to your attention that in fact we would have to rescind the committee's action that failed to move the bill out of committee on May the 3rd when we had a 3-3 vote.
Right.
And I'd love for you to speak on it, and then perhaps we can revisit this issue on Monday.
Okay. Do you want me to make a rescission motion on Monday?
No. Yes. I think on Monday, just give you an opportunity just to...
We need to do the rescission when we vote.
If we vote, yes. So I think you really can just take a moment just to speak on it, just to refresh the members of what your intent is with House Bill 237.
Okay. And I don't know if you have your bill files. It's the bill to provide a procedure...
You have 3 minutes, Representative Gruenberg.
I can delay until Monday.
No, I'm just joking. Go ahead. You're good.
If it just provides the procedure for the governor, due process to remove a regent, either suspend the regent or remove it for cause.
Okay. All right. And pending our schedule, the first of the week, we will take that up and at least have a vibrant discussion about it and see to rescinding our actions possibly and revoting the bill. All right, there are no more issues before the committee. It is exactly 3 p.m. I thank the House Judiciary members for their excellent work today. We are adjourned. Are we